From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, creating hip animated shows around characters that are uncool, we talk with Mike Judge. He's the self-taught animator who created Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill. The first season of King of the Hill is now available on DVD. Also, Lost in La Mancha is the documentary about director Terry Gilliam's disastrous attempt to make a movie of the classic story of Don Quixote. It's also out on DVD. We'll hear about some of the mishaps from Terry Gilliam. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Macy Gray's new album, The Trouble with Being Myself, and film critic David Edelstein reviews American Splendor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Millions of people across the Northeast are slowly regaining electricity, but officials are asking them not to use too much of it. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
A number of city officials say their power grids remain overburdened. To avoid another mass failure, they're imposing rolling blackouts and asking residents to conserve. They suggest not using appliances or air conditioners despite stifling heat. Water supplies dependent on electricity also remain fragile, and some gas stations have been unable to restore their pumps. Toronto's Mayor Mel Lastman has this advice.
Don't water your lawn or wash your car. Don't go out and drive unless it's absolutely necessary, and if you do so, be careful and treat intersections without traffic lights as four-way stop signs.
Officials warn that thousands must continue to make do over the weekend and possibly beyond until full service is restored. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
It's still not clear what caused the nearly instantaneous outages in parts of 8 states and Canada. President Bush called the event a wake-up call that the nation's utility distribution system needs fixing.
You know, I've been concerned that our infrastructure, the delivery system, is old and antiquated. And I think this is an indication of the fact that we need to modernize the electricity grid.
Meanwhile, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg said electricity has been restored to much of his city.
At this point in time, something over 85% of the city now has full power. And there are a few neighborhoods that still don't, and hopefully we'll be back by early evening or sometime this evening.
In Canada, officials are still using rolling blackouts to hold down power use. They say it'll be several days before electricity is fully restored throughout Ontario. Karen Kelly reports from Ottawa.
In Ottawa, residents are experiencing hour-long blackouts about every 2 hours. Power officials say they have enough electricity to meet half of the normal demand. Only 4 of Ontario's 11 nuclear power plants are up and running, and just half of the 19 coal-burning plants are operating. Ron Stewart, the director of Hydro Ottawa, says there's no end in sight.
To get this remaining generation reconnected to the grid and supplying power could take several days. So I expect the rationing to go on for some time.
The cities of Toronto and Ottawa have set up shelters where people can escape the heat. They say residents should keep their air conditioners turned off. For NPR News, I'm Karen Kelly in Ottawa.
In stocks, the Dow gained 11 to close at 9,321. The NASDAQ was up 1 at 1,702. This is NPR News. Libya has delivered a letter to the United Nations taking responsibility for the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, 15 years ago. The move could pave the way for the lifting of UN sanctions as early as next week, NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
A senior State Department official said Libya met just the minimum requirements to have UN sanctions lifted and suggested that the U.S. would probably abstain from a vote on the issue. As for separate U.S. sanctions, the official made clear Libya does not deserve a clean bill of health. Dan Cohen, whose daughter was killed in the Pan Am bombing, said he was pleased with some of the tough rhetoric from Secretary of State Colin Powell, who met with the families of the victims.
I think that so long as that Muammar Gaddafi and his clique are in control of Libya, the United States should have no relationship whatsoever with what is a criminal, terrorist, murdering regime.
Other relatives of the victims say they were assured the U.S. would proceed with an ongoing criminal investigation of the bombing. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Hurricane warnings have been posted along the Texas Gulf Coast and parts of Mexico as Tropical Storm Erica gains strength. The storm surprised people along the Gulf Coast with its speed and growing power. Erica is predicted to come ashore tomorrow morning in the Brownsville area, and forecasters say its winds may well exceed the 74-mile-per-hour speed that marks the lower limit of a hurricane. Fishermen and other boat owners were busy getting their craft to safety. Just last month, Hurricane Claudette battered the same area with maximum sustained winds of 85 miles per hour and drenching rain. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Warner Home Video, featuring Roger and Me, Michael Moore's first film, available soon on DVD.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. The first season of the animated television series King of the Hill is now out on DVD. Mike Judge is the creator of King of the Hill. There was a time in the mid-90s when many parents considered Judge public enemy number one. He was the man behind Beavis and Butthead, two trash-talking, metal rock-worshipping cartoon characters who were stars of MTV programming and later of a hit feature film. King of the Hill aired on Fox. It's about a conservative-minded, decent, and utterly uncool guy who lives with his family in a small town in Texas and faces the bewildering twists of modern culture with the help of his trio of misfit pals. King of the Hill premiered in January 1997. Since then, Hank Hill has had to deal with his wife's Peggy's bid to become state boggle champion, his live-in niece's conversion to Christian fundamentalism, and his son Bobby being picked by Buddhist priests to be the next Dalai Lama. In 1999, the show won an Emmy for Outstanding Animated Program. Let's hear a clip from the first season. In this episode, Peggy has just been hired as a substitute teacher for Bobby's fifth-grade sex ed class. Here she is standing in front of the mirror, practicing some anatomical terms.
Happiness. 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 Penis. I did it. Ovaries. Uvula. Uterus. Vagina! Hey, Hank. I just said...
I heard you. The whole neighborhood can hear you cussing.
It's not cussing, Hank, to say the name of a God-given body part.
Well, it is if it's a part of the body that was meant to be concealed by an undergarment. You're dealing with organs that people just don't want to know about.
Well, Bobby ought to know about them. We don't want him growing up as repressed as we did.
Sure we do. I'm drawing the line here, Peggy. My son is not going to learn this crazy crap. It says right here he can't take the class without permission of both his parents.
Now, just hold on. Are you saying I am not good enough to teach my own son?
If you do not approve, you do not have to sign, and I do not approve. Permission denied.
Mike Judge, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What I really like about Hank Hill is that he's this conservative guy trying to make sense of things and treat people with humanity in a world that is just has gone terribly wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what's fun is to have the world be wrong and Hank be right, you know, even though he's not king of the world, he's maybe king of his block.
Hank's pals are really a wonderful trio. One's an exterminator consumed by conspiracy theories. Another's a barber in the army with very low self-esteem. And then there's Boomhauer, who you also supply the voice for. And he's kind of this rockabilly type, and he's known for being completely unintelligible. Can you do some Boomhauer for us, for people who are not familiar with his garbled speech?
Yeah, Boomhauer, I'd wanted to do an animated character like this for a while, whose accent was so thick that you couldn't follow him. Because there's a guy I knew in Dallas that, especially after he'd been drinking, you kind of knew what he was talking about, but you didn't know what he was saying. And it's also based on a guy who called to complain about Beavis and Butthead, who left a voice message.
That got replayed and replayed and
yeah, that I listened to
many times. Studio.
Yeah, and he was, I don't know if you can say this on NPR, but you could bleep it out, I guess. He thought the name of the show, for some reason, he thought the name of the show was Porky's Butthole. I don't know how he got that out of Beavis and Butthead, but his phone call, he was, I don't know what he was saying. Now, I've been calling y'all better month now. Grab about y'all every time them dang old pokey freaking old butthole come on. And y'all been jobbing them old dang old commercials on and on every time like y'all do last time, you know. Uh-huh. And I was calling a guy for directions once in Oklahoma City and got a Boomhauer kind of guy who's just, so, hey, yeah, you know, come on that on that old pass, you know, coming on the off-ramp, and you turn around and it's going to be right there, you know. And so that's, you know, that sort of thing. He's also, like, I think Boomhauer, I think of him as, like, if he had grown up in Southern California, he probably would have been a surfer for life, you know. And he's one of those guys everybody likes. He doesn't say much, but girls like him and guys like him, you know. He's kind of a good-looking guy, kind of mysterious.
How has the series changed or developed in 100 episodes?
A lot of the characters have developed in a really good way. You know, it's taken on a life of its own, and it's all through just, you know, it's a big collaborative process. There's writers, and I think the voice actors actually have a lot to do with it. Peggy has developed into one of my favorite characters. When in the beginning, it was one of those things where I wasn't quite sure, you know, like, what do we do with her? And I'm not great with female characters anyway. And it just kind of happened. Something, it takes on a life of its own, and it's a grand sum of all the people who are working on it. Really,
Peggy is wonderful. She's a boggle champion. She has a lot of skills under her belt. She's a real feminist, too. Self-actualized,
yeah.
Even though she lives in Arlen, Texas.
Yeah. Actually, when Greg Daniels came onto the project after I'd done the first draft of the pilot, that was one of the things, you know, I was saying, help me out with this. I can't figure this character out. And what he did, he started asking me questions about, he's like playing psychologist. He said, okay, describe your mother. And my mom was actually a Spanish teacher in high school and a substitute for most of the time I was growing up. And my grandmother, she had a degree in Spanish, but she's from Montana. She was always writing, and she got published like in Atlantic Monthly, but they were all very kind of like, she got published as this mountain woman, you know, who's writing about they were homesteaders, you know, up in Montana, her family. And so we just kind of started talking. So a lot of that stuff made it into the show. I mean, Peggy's from Montana in King of the Hill, and she's a substitute Spanish teacher. And I should probably be careful what I say here. My mom may be listening. But I mean, it's not, my mom's actually very different because she pronounces Spanish perfectly and Peggy Hill pronounces horribly. She's probably closer to my grandmother.
You have kind of an eclectic background. You were a physics major in college. You worked as an engineer. And then you also performed in bands. How'd you get interested in animation?
Well, I've always been interested in animation since high school, and I guess I was just too much of a wuss to actually commit to it ever and to really try to, you know, like, in college I just thought, well, you know, I don't want to waste 4 years of tuition on a film degree or something, you know, because it just seemed like back then it was all science. You know, if you ever want a job, you've got to have a science degree, and math and physics came fairly easily to me, and so I did that. But, you know, I mean, in the back of my mind, my pipe dream was always to go into comedy in some way, but I knew I couldn't be a stand-up comedian or anything, but, you know, I wanted to write and do this and that, but, you know, you just, how do you do that? I had no idea how you become one of the guys on Second City TV or Saturday Night Live or anything. And so I finally got the idea to do animation. I just thought, well, when I realized that one person can animate like a 2-minute short, it just takes you like 6 or 7 weeks to do. But then I thought, wow, this is something I can do on my own. I don't need anybody. I don't need to get a bunch of people together and try to do sketches or something. I guess it just took me a while to realize that. But I had always been interested in it, and I've always done imitations and done drawings since high school.
Do you write jokes for King of the Hill? One-liners, gag lines?
Well, I personally don't like doing that, and a lot of times we end up having that, and I'm always the guy who kills it, you know? The reason a lot of sitcoms go bad is they kind of deteriorate into every character becoming a smart aleck, because I think that's just easier to write than to come up with situations where the comedy comes out of just, you know, the characters and observational kind of things, you know. That's actually like I guess it's because normal people in everyday life aren't constantly saying smart aleck comebacks that it took a Harvard Lampoon guy 3 hours to come up with, you know. It breaks the reality of it, and I just don't like that. I lose interest in shows where some, you know, 14-year-old hot-looking underwear model girl says, yeah, the last time you brushed your teeth, there were 5 more communist countries in the world. You know, it's just like, I just don't care about those kind of characters, so.
That's funny, though, to imagine you killing all these jokes. Does your heart ever sink? At least I should leave one in.
Not usually. Once in a while, if it's funnier than it is unrealistic, then it's okay. And because I've, you know, but on Beavis and Butthead, I remember this, I guess, just because there was a journalist in the room who wrote about it, where somebody had written Beavis saying, yeah, that guy, he's going to have Beavis envy, like a penis envy joke. And I just thought, no, Beavis is not going to, Beavis isn't that clever.
Mike Judge is the creator of the animated TV series King of the Hill. The first season is now available on DVD. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back now with Mike Judge, creator of the hit animated TV series King of the Hill. The first season is now out on DVD. Let's talk about Beavis and Butthead. For people who don't remember, they were a sensation on MTV, I think over 6-7 seasons in the early 90s.
Something like that. The seasons were, we do 2 a year sometimes, so who knows. Yeah, early 90s to went off the air and I want to say 97, yeah, November 97.
They were quite repulsive 14-year-olds who sat on a couch in front of the TV and made fun of everything. They also ventured forth once in a while to work part-time at a burger joint. I want to play this clip from an episode called Blackout because it has one of my favorite made-up names for a TV drama series, Asbestos in Obstetrics, starring Melissa Gilbert.
Hey, Butthead. What is asbestos?
It's like health food or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Tell the commissioner we need that helicopter. I don't care what it costs. No, I'm not shipping in.
This sucks.
Huh?
Huh? Yeah. Hey, Butthead, what's wrong with the TV?
I don't know. Let's kick it.
Yeah, let's kick it. Let's kick it. Kick it.
That's from Beavis and Butthead, which aired on MTV in the 90s, produced and created by my guest Mike Judge. And Mike Judge also was the voice of Beavis and Butthead. Who were these guys? Where'd you call them?
It started out as drawings in my sketchbook, and I'm not sure what I was going for. I hated being 14 and being in junior high, and I remember thinking around that time that I drew them that there are 14-year-olds kind of looked the same then. This was like 1990 or whatever that they did as they did when I was in high school. They were still wearing AC/DC T-shirts, and my high school reunion had actually just happened, and a friend of mine was talking about this guy I knew in high school who's actually very different from Beavis and Butthead. He was a straight A student, but he kind of had a spastic laugh that was it was a little deeper than Beavis. He was sitting at front of the class, kind of sucking up to the teacher all the time and laughing at everything the teacher would say. And his laugh was kind of and so I made two attempts at drawing him. I actually tried to draw him like four times, and none of them looked like him, but a couple of them became Beavis and Butthead. But I guess they're kind of like, I don't know, they started out as being completely repulsive characters, definitely. I mean, that was the point, completely moronic. The way I think of it, in the beginning anyway, was I remember, I'm always struck by how out of touch it seems that people in entertainment and in the news are. And I remember hearing one of these statistics you always hear, like 80% of high school kids in some town couldn't locate the United States on a globe if it wasn't marked. And, you know, the news reporter was shocked. I wasn't that shocked. Because I remember junior high, and to me, they're like that 80%, you know.
The thing that a lot of people liked about Beavis and Butthead was that they were really stupid, but they'd sit there and they'd watch TV, they'd watch American popular culture, and they'd know it was so stupid.
Yeah, that's what was really fun, was to have, like, also I think when you, sometimes if you free your mind of intellectual matters, a lot of truth can come out that just comes out from some gut level, and that's fun, you know. And it was also like, actually very early on when MTV first bought it, they showed my original shorts to a focus group and sent me a tape of it. And right before mine, the tape had, you know, it's a, like a one-way mirror. You're looking at like 14 mall rats just sitting there watching stuff, you know. It was really funny. They'd show them something like Aeon Flux, which is this really intricate, this Japanese animation style, real, you know, they'd show them really artsy stuff, and these kids would just go, well, that was dumb. And there's something really funny about that, you know, everyone's efforts, you know, making these videos and all these kind of high concept things, and just the reality that the real audience is a couple of 14-year-olds just going, you know. So, by the way, that wasn't the Butthead laugh. That was my own laugh right there.
thanks for clarifying.
That was my own dumb laugh.
You do a lot of the writing, and you're doing the voices on King of the Hill, but you're pretty affluent. By now, after all is said and done, is there a place you go, like the local bar, to you know, keep your ear fresh?
Well, I can always go to Home Depot, hang out there, get some inspiration. I have a thing about grocery stores. I like going to the grocery store. I know grocery stores are like. It's like when I saw Breakfast at Tiffany's and she's talking about how nice it is in the jewelry store, I thought, yeah, that's how I feel about grocery stores. You know, it's all this food. It's all, they try to make it a nice environment, and it really is. So, And the grocery stores in New York always smell like rotten meat, but down here they, in Texas and L.A., they, I don't know, somehow they manage to make them smell nice. But I got sidetracked there. I actually, the neighborhood I live in Austin is, yeah, it's pretty affluent, but not so much that, it's one of those typical things that's happened in the suburbs where there's like brand new houses and then the old hillbilly guy who's lived there forever is right next door to me. And so I still, you know, I just put gas in my car, go to the grocery store, go to Home Depot. It's not, you know, it's still, it's not like I'm in a castle somewhere. And Austin is, although it's not a typical Texas town at all, parts of it are, you know. It's parts of it are, you know, there's also lots of artists and filmmakers and musicians, but there's also regular people there, too.
Which character on King of the Hill is most like you?
Probably Hank. I mean, people, friends of mine have said that Hank's probably the closest of all the stuff I've done, including Beavis and Butthead, to me. Although my roommate in college insists that Butthead was the closest to me.
Mike Judge, creator and executive producer of the animated TV series King of the Hill. The first season is now out on DVD. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey there, Bobby. I guess they found a cure for the cooties.
I don't know. What are cooties?
Well, when I was a boy, that's what we called the germs you got from girls.
Oh, you mean like chlamydia?
Huh?
What on earth are you two talking about?
Bobby was invited to his first boy-girl party.
A boy-girl party? Already?
Well, I don't think I want to go.
Well, that's just fine, Bobby. Would you like a juice box?
Wait a minute. Son, why would you not want to go to a boy-girl party?
Parties are fun, Bobby. Everybody dresses up and gets a touch dance.
Touch dance? I don't know. What if I get filled up?
Oh, you just need some practice.
Luann's right. All you need is practice. You think Jeff Foxworthy just woke up one day and took some funny pills?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Warner Brothers Pictures and Matchstick Men, a Ridley Scott film with Nicolas Cage and Sam Rockwell as a couple of pros in the small-time con, in theaters Friday, September 12th. And by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Moth Diaries, a novel about obsessions that drive people through adolescence, by author Rachel Klein. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lost in La Mancha. We talk with Terry Gilliam about what went wrong when he attempted to make a film about the classic Don Quixote story. Ken Tucker reviews Macy Gray's new album. And David Edelstein reviews the new movie, American Splendor.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Macy Gray's 1999 debut album, How Life Is, was an immediate success, selling over 4 million copies. But after so-so sales of her follow-up, The Id, in 2001, Gray seemed in danger of becoming a one-hit wonder. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Gray's new album, The Trouble With Being Myself, should do a lot to reestablish Gray as a unique pop voice.
To call Macy Gray's new album, The Trouble With Being Myself, delightful is to minimize its sensual intelligence and considerable emotional depth. But let's hear it for delight first anyway. Gray's third collection is crammed with easygoing rhythm section grooves, topped by chicken scratch guitar riffs, plonking piano chords, and nimble horn charts that span 60s soul and the jauntier aspects of present-day hip-hop. This is the most loose yet disciplined music Gray has made. Whether she's singing about the joys of making up after a fight on that lead-off cut, When I See You, or extolling the virtues of good sex in a frolicsome, innocent way on Screamin'.
Don't hear nothing but bad news lately, and all my family has gone crazy, but I guess it don't matter since the world is gonna end.
Gray's previous effort, The Id, was, well, an effort. The overwrought, overproduced work of an artist coping with debut album mega success. Trouble, by contrast, could have been called the superego. It's all strut and confidence, full of advice for a happier life. This itself is bracing, since Gray can come off on stage as a likable nutcase, scattered and distracted. There's a tradition for that sort of image in R&B, of course. Al Green can seem addled in his pursuance of the divine. And George Clinton's P-Funk is, among many other things, an elaborate excuse to behave wackily on stage. And Gray's hardcore devotees understand this pose as a way to cope with fame and perhaps her genuine shyness. Others, however, to judge from the relatively weak sales of The Id, wrote her off too soon, as it turns out from the evidence here.
There's a place that's good for me, got money.
The title of The Trouble With Being Myself tips off the listener that Gray hasn't lost any of her self-absorption. A song called Jesus for a Day should be enough to rest my case. But the song I just played, She Don't Write Songs About You, is primarily why a guy who's not reciprocating should love her simply for the reason her diehard fans do, quote, because I'm Macy Gray. To be sure, no Gray release would be complete without at least one song that rattles her audience a little. That tune here is My Fondest Childhood Memories, a peppy, Latin-inflected melody written in the first person, whose lyric describes the way a young Macy killed tempters who she believes slept with her mother and her father. Gray cheerfully announces that she was let off for her crimes because of her youth. Here's a measure of the universal honesty of her imagination. Who among us hasn't had such vindictive thoughts of someone who may have wronged us and further dreamed of getting away with it? The depth I referred to earlier can be found on this album's nuanced, varied theme of how deeply love cuts and heals. You can hear it in the aching plaintiveness of She Ain't Right for You and Speechless. In her insistence that contentment is best enjoyed with an equal partner on both Happiness and Screamin'. These add up to a remarkable cluster of songs, entrancing in their mastery of styles from Sly Stone party music to Stevie Wonder balladry. From its shrewdly knowing title to the barbed hooks that snag you into nearly every song on The Trouble with Being Myself, Macy Gray is in complete, serene control.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Coming up, Lost in La Mancha. Director Terry Gilliam tells us about his biggest fiasco. This is Fresh Air. The documentary film Lost in La Mancha is the story of director Terry Gilliam's disastrous attempt to adapt Cervantes' Don Quixote to the screen. It's just out on DVD. Gilliam says he knew before he started that the project had a cursed history. Orson Welles had also tried to make a film version of the novel, only to have a starring actor die before the movie could be completed. But the odds didn't daunt him, as a director Gilliam has always pushed the limits. He started out as an animator for Monty Python's Flying Circus and co-directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He went on to direct Brazil, Time Bandits, 12 Monkeys, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, The Fisher King, and The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. Brazil and Baron Munchausen earned Gilliam the reputation in Hollywood of a visionary and battler of windmills, so it seemed a perfect match that Gilliam would take on Don Quixote, until it all went wrong. How wrong? That's the subject of the documentary Lost in La Mancha. I spoke with Gilliam last January when the film was in theaters. So you worked on this film, Quixote, for 10 years, and you went through two producers. You tried to start the film twice, and this is all before the attempt portrayed in the Lost in La Mancha documentary. But finally, you pulled together a production team from all over Europe. You had no Hollywood backing, and you all assembled in Madrid for pre-production. How did things go at that point? For instance, one problem you had, your stars, Johnny Depp, who played Sancho Panza, and the French actor Jean Rochefort, who plays Don Quixote, they don't show up for pre-production costume fittings or rehearsal. In fact, I think at one point in the film, it seems as if you can't get Johnny Depp on the phone at all.
Correct.
That must have been disconcerting. How worried were you?
No, I wasn't. I'm not worried about Johnny, and I wasn't worried about Jean either, to be honest. I mean, because the one thing, having worked with Johnny, I know this is a guy who can turn up 5 minutes before you start shooting, and it'll be amazing. That doesn't worry me. It gets frustrating because there's always things you want to talk about, and you start tearing your hair out because you can't. And Johnny was busy doing the film From Hell, and he was in Prague, so he was under the gun because they were running late. And I was worried that he wasn't going to get there in time. And in fact, he was so exhausted, he did take a week off before he finally got down there. But the fact is, he was ready. But with Jean, because he'd achieved a hernia in about a month before he started shooting. And the result of that was that it was starting to press on his prostate, and the prostate became infected. And what was shocking is when he did turn up, because he did not get on a plane and then he got down there, was that I suddenly was dealing with a man that was about 20 years older than I'd last seen him a month earlier. It was quite extraordinary because he's 70 years old. He raises show jumping horses. A man has never lost a day of shooting in his life. He's far more fit than I would ever hope to be. And this nasty little organ became infected, and he literally went from what seemed like a 50-year-old man to a 90-year-old man almost overnight.
He did show up for filming. You began filming the movie, and the first day of shooting, the trouble seemed to begin. What went wrong right from the start?
Well, there was a little problem about the extras not being rehearsed in a particular fight sequence. That was the moment I went berserk, because, again, What happened? It's a problem in films, because especially on something like this, I was working with some people I hadn't worked with before. So you're relying on other people's knowledge of them. And there are always some people on the film that spend most of their time trying to impress the director by being incredibly charming rather than going out and doing the hard graft work. And I stumbled on one of those people, unfortunately. And something hadn't been done. Rehearsal hadn't taken place. We're out in the middle of this hot desert area with always limited amount of time. And nobody's prepared themselves properly for that moment. And that was a huge shock. I mean, I did go crazy because it was something I didn't expect.
I think the words you use are, you need to tell me if I'm going to be expletive deleted beforehand. I need to know if I'm...
If I am, I want to know in advance.
That's right.
All I ask. And that's, I mean, it's very funny because I think the four-letter F word I use more than, you know, 1,000 times in the documentary. I think I was quite amazed at how limited my dialogue had become.
The second day of filming was the real disaster. In the documentary, it looks as if a hurricane blew in while you were shooting on location in the Spanish desert. It really looks like a storm of biblical proportions.
No, it was.
What was it like on the set?
I was exhilarated, frankly. Because suddenly, a lot of my concerns about our production problems and potential future problems had all been taken away from me by this hand of this rather violent God. It was quite extraordinary the way it built, because it was a slow build, and we thought, oh, there's some clouds coming, oh, there's a little problem. And when it hit, it was literally like the beginning of Wizard of Oz. And in fact, I'm running around trying to decide whether I'm in the Wizard of Oz or if I'm playing King Lear in The Tempest, in the storm. It was quite extraordinary, because we were under this marquee and all the equipment was there, all the people were there, and I just walked out into the storm. I was so crazed at that point, howling, and I found a large overhanging rock, which I crouched under, as this storm started building, and it got bigger and more spectacular. It was absolutely beautiful in its anger, I think. And little by little, I started watching water pouring down these mountainsides, which were dry, and suddenly there became waterfalls, and then there was a rush of water, and then hailstones started crashing down, and eventually, after about 45 minutes, it ended. And I had been under this rock looking away from the set, and I crawl out from under my rock and look back, and there's nothing there. A sea of mud is all that's left.
You did regroup and began filming again. And I suppose this is when the most ironic misfortune happened, something that truly elevates this La Mancha story to a fiasco. And that's that your star, Jean Rochefort, fell ill, and he couldn't ride a horse. Now, we have a clip from the movie. It's from the day of shooting that you realize Rochefort is too ill to ride. Let's listen. And here you've just filmed a take and notice something is wrong, and you're on the set talking to your first director, Phil.
Cut! Did you see him sit on the horse?
Crazy.
The pain when he sat down.
Yep. He can't do it. It's just, it ain't going to happen.
I was watching his face very carefully when he got on that horse, and it was just...
He can't ride like that. He certainly can't act like that, and he certainly can't jiggle hand props with that. You know, I want to go to the French and say I'm going to refuse to shoot with Jean Rochefort on a horse until he's medically fit.
That's a scene from the documentary Lost in La Mancha about my guest Terry Gilliam's failed attempt to adapt Don Quixote to the screen. So here you have a Don Quixote who can't ride a horse. Did you know at that point just how physically impaired Rochefort was?
I think we did, because the irony was that when I had been hunting for a Don Quixote who had to look a certain way and be a certain height, and a certain age, always the problem was that you could find an actor who looked right but couldn't ride a horse. It was the one thing that Jean was absolutely expert at. He was a brilliant horseman, so... On that day when he was on that horse and you realized, looked in his face and you saw the pain he was in, we knew we were in trouble. I mean, I didn't know how bad the trouble was, because we broke for lunch and Phil Patterson, the first assistant director, said, I'm not going to let you put him back on a horse. I mean, the man's in real trouble. And I said, well, no. We better talk to Jean. And And Jean said, listen, I've been here all week. I've been able to do nothing. I don't think I'll be able to get through the weekend unless I'm able to do a scene. I've spent 7-8 months learning English to do this, and I'm going to do it. And then the producers had said, yo, he must go back on his horse. And then talked to Johnny Depp and said, what do you think, Johnny? And Johnny said, well, if he really wants to do it, I mean, you can't say no. And I said, he's an adult. So we put him back on the horse. And all we did, he was on the horse for about 45 minutes, just walking. And at the end of it, it took two people to lift him off the horse. And he was in bed, and he was on the plane the next day to Paris. It's that thing with actors, and that's why I love them, but they can almost kill themselves in trying to do their work. And Jean almost did that.
Rochefort left after that day's shooting, and he promised to return in 2 days. He was seeing doctors in Paris, but 2 days became 4, and then 10, and then I guess maybe never. what was going on while you waited in limbo to find out your star's prognosis? Were producers coming to you saying, why can't we recast? Find a different Quixote. Bruce Willis.
There was all of that going on. The insurance company in particular said, recast. And I said, well, we spent almost a year trying to get to this point. How do you just suddenly recast? Because there aren't many people out there that fill the bill. And I said, we've also got very complicated schedule problems. To reschedule is going to be very difficult and costly. And because we were, an independent production, there was no fat in the budget. And I said, I don't know how we can do all of that. Johnny felt very strongly, as indeed did a lot of the cast and the crew, that let's wait for Jean. Maybe it'll only be a month. Maybe it'll be 2 months. We'll all go away. We won't charge any money for waiting. And when he's well, we'll come back and continue the film. And I was on that side. That's what I wanted to do. But we were given a deadline to come up with an answer, either recast or reschedule or whatever, or they'd pull the plug, and I just felt we couldn't in the time put it together in a new form, and so they pulled the plug.
At some point in the documentary, you're on the phone and you're explaining to someone that you just lost all sense of what the film was, that you had the whole film in your head. You carry these images around in your head, this vision of it all, for a decade, and it's just dribbled out of you.
Well, I think it becomes such a, I don't know, maybe it's a way of surviving. Maybe my system just shut down and sort of closed the door on it. Maybe that's what it was, because having spent, you're torn, because on one hand, you spent so long at it, you're tired of it, you hate it, and you're worn out with it. On another hand, you just want to get it up on the screen. And so your system is doing bizarre things. And I think physically I was so exhausted, and then you had the emotional exhaustion on top. It was kind of like, on one level, there was a relief. Ah, the nightmare is over. I can go back to some other kind of life. And you think you've got over it, and then it would hit you like a month later. What a complete and utter waste of years of your life this has been. And it comes and goes. It's why I am still going to make the film, because the only way I can deal with these problems is to convince myself that, yes, we will do it, and we'll do it in a year or two.
What occurs to you when you watch the documentary?
What occurs to me that I should never watch it again is what occurs to me.
Did you watch it?
Yes, I've watched it several times, and I can't stand it. It leaves me depressed for a couple of weeks, and I'm trying to get my life back.
Terry Gilliam, it was such a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Director Terry Gilliam. When we spoke, he was in negotiations with the insurance company to get back the rights to his script, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. The documentary about the making of the film, Lost in La Mancha, is now out on DVD. Coming up, a review of the new film, American Splendor. This is Fresh Air. The new movie, American Splendor, is an adaptation of the comic book series of the same name. The comics are autobiographical stories by Harvey Pekar, which document his drab daily life as a file clerk in a VA hospital. American Splendor stars Paul Giamatti as Pekar and Hope Davis as his wife, Joyce Brabner. The movie won the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Millions of people have been helped by the newest class of antidepressants, but I'm glad that those drugs weren't around in the 70s and early 80s, when Harvey Pekar was at his lowest ebb in Cleveland. Successfully medicated, he'd still have had his whiny sense of entitlement, but possibly not that last punishing drop of misery that drove him to make something beautiful and enduring. The series of underground comics he called, only half ironically, American Splendor. In the early 80s, when the agenda was suddenly set by Reaganite yuppies, and it wasn't hip to be a sad sack malcontent railing against the government and hanging out with poor people, Pekar's was a voice of consolation. Along with his illustrators, most famously R. Crumb, he found the tender mercies, the moments of transcendence, in the mingiest places. He consciously invoked the great American naturalist writers like Theodore Dreiser, but the story he maintained didn't need to end with the hero being crushed by a convergence of character flaws and social forces. It could end with the hero sniffing a fresh loaf of bread and living to mope another day. Or even having his life turned into a delightful movie. The new film, directed by Sherry Springer Berman and Robert Pulcini, isn't in quite the same key as Pekar's work. The tempo is buoyant and self-conscious, with the one-step-back level that we nowadays call meta. American Splendor isn't framed as the story of a lonely, self-styled schlub who works as a hospital file clerk, collects old jazz LPs, and searches for meaning. It's the story of a lonely, self-styled schlub who gets famous, meets the mate he deserves, then bumps up against his own mortality. Licking cancer, for the time being, Pekar gets to hang out on this very movie set and bask in his own celebrity. American Splendor glides in on that celebrity. In the early scenes, it gives you the man himself. Interviewed in a studio against a white backdrop, Pekar says of Paul Giamatti, the actor who's playing him, "He don't look nothing like me." But whatever. Which might have killed the illusion in the cradle if the actor weren't as nervy as Giamatti, who goes Pekar to Pekar with the real McCoy and doesn't blink. But Giamatti isn't really playing Pekar. He's the alter ego Pekar concocted for his comic, a sad-eyed, misanthropic humanist, like Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh, only surly. You watch him as he trudges around the city, hunched over, a chip on his shoulder the size of Cleveland, and wonder how a man could survive under the weight of so much surus. Yet he's strangely open to everything, and so is this movie. It has scratchy animated frames and captions that evoke the comic's edginess and a free-floating jazz score by Mark Suazo that might remind you of Peanuts, which was also about a bunch of neurotics disguised as kids hanging out and griping and developing odd fixations. About a third of the way in, Pekar meets Joyce Brabner, played by Hope Davis, in the Hope Davis performance we've been waiting for. As Joyce, she has a sort of radioactive drabness. The dull brown hair hangs defiantly limp. The glasses are freakishly oversized. The voice is a post-nasal drip that somehow sings. Joyce and Harvey's first date is a getting-to-know-you scene that will enter the annals of American weirdness.
We got a lot of meat on this menu.
You're a vegetarian?
Kinda, you know. I mean, ever since I got a pet cat, you know, I've had a lot of trouble eating animals.
I support and identify with groups like PETA, but unfortunately, I'm a self-diagnosed anemic.
Uh-huh.
Also, I have all these food allergies to vegetables, which give me serious intestinal distress. I guess I have a lot of borderline health disorders that limit me politically when it comes to eating.
Wow, you're a sick woman.
Not yet, but I expect to be. Everyone in my family has some sort of degenerative illness.
You'll have even more fun seeing that scene. Davis doesn't flinch as she recites her litany of illnesses, and Jamadi looks at once smitten and sick, as if Cupid's arrow had been tipped with a gastrointestinal virus. When the movie ran actual footage from Picard's famously antagonistic appearances on Late Night with David Letterman, I was reminded why I hated them back in the 80s. Letterman's shtick was making fun of the folks back home, whereas Picard's comic barrels through ironic derision and comes out the other end, into acceptance. The movie makes that contrast clear in every spacious, compassionate, un-Letterman-like frame. American Splendor opens with a scene in which the young Picard goes trick-or-treating without a costume, as himself, and is taken aback when people regard him as peculiar beside all the kids in superhero get-ups. And now we have a movie that's more thrilling than Daredevil, more powerful than Hulk, more freaky than X-Men, proof that so-called ordinary people can hold the comics and the screen even better than superheroes. This Halloween, I want to be Harvey Picard.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.